didn't get turned on. Did you guys not have that TV when you guys were?
We did, but I could be wrong. I might have been looking down there.
Be a little careful when that one's on. There we go. Last week we talked about how God used Empire Babylon to punish disobedient Judah. But there's difficulty in there because why punish Judah with someone worse than Judah, meaning Babylon? And the Lord said to Habakkuk this about Empire Babylon, which we talked about sort of runs true again and again and again. See, the enemy is puffed up. His desires are not upright, but the righteous person will live by his faithfulness. Indeed, wine betrays him. He is arrogant and never at rest, because he is as greedy as the grave, and like death, is never satisfied. He gathers to himself all the nations and takes captives all the people. There's a famous quote that's often attributed to Abraham Lincoln. They can't really find a source, a quotation where Lincoln actually said it, but it's a good saying. Nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power. There's a lot of truth to that. Now, today, just like last week we looked at the whole book of Habakkuk, today we're going to look at the book of Esther. Now, that's a bit more of a challenge because Esther is quite a bit of a longer book than Habakkuk. And so for many of you, I'm going to sort of rely on your knowledge of the book of Esther a bit. I'm going to hit the salient points that fit into Advent here. But if you've never read the book of Esther, it's in the Old Testament, and you should definitely read it because it's an amazing book. It's a fun book. I really don't know why they don't make more Hollywood movies from Bible stories, because these Bible stories are some of the best stories that you can find anywhere. The book of Esther opens now not in Babylon. Babylon has been taken over by the Persians, and Xerxes is a Persian emperor. And the Jews, after the Babylonian exile, have been dispersed throughout the empire. And so there are Jews living in Susa, the royal city of the Persian Empire. But we're going to begin with the empire of Persia. And what God said to Habakkuk about the Babylonians is just as true as the Persians. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces were present. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendid glory of his majesty. Think about a 180-day party. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet. 180 days was not enough, lasting 7 days. In the enclosed garden of the king's palace, for all the people from the least to the greatest who were in the citadel of Susa. The gardens had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material, to silver rings, to marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver, on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. You get the picture. Pulled out all the stops, wealth, opulence displayed. Xerxes is showing the world he's the king of the world. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other. Lots of different wines, lots of different goblets. The royal wine was abundant, in keeping with the king's liberality. Now, remember, see, the enemy is puffed up. His desires are not right. Indeed, wine betrays him. We will see if wine betrays Xerxes. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink with no restrictions. For the king instructed all of the wine stewards to serve each man what he wanted. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. Not unusual in many cultures. Men over here, women over there. Just a little bit less drama. And you know what happens when everybody gets a lot of wine and men and women sort of start to mingle. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from the wine, will the wine betray him? He commanded the seven eunuchs who served him to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her golden crown. Doesn't say anything else, but there it is. In order to display her beauty to the people and the nobles, for she was lovely to look at. 7 days of wine, everybody's been drinking, and my queen is hot. Bring her out here, let's have a look. Was wine going to betray him? But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. Then the steward replied in the presence of the king and the nobles, Queen Vashti has done wrong, one of the nobles. Not only against the king, but against all the nobles and the people of all the provinces of Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, so they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. This very day, the Persian and Median women of nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There'll be no end of disrespect and discord. In other words, Queen Vashti is setting the pace. If you let her get away with this, all of our wives won't want to come out and be the trophy wives we've married them all to be. You've got to lay the line here, Xerxes. The marriages of the nobility and their character are all on the line here. Therefore, if it pleases the king, this is going to set up a whole series of, hey, king, how about this law? Oh, sounds like a good idea. It's not going to go well. If it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree and let it be written on the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter into the presence of King Xerxes. And let this go out, and everybody will know it. And, oh, sounds like a good idea. And so it goes out throughout the kingdom. But later, when the wine is gone, and King Xerxes' fury had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done, and what he had done, she had done, and what he had decreed about her. Oh, wine betrayed him. Wasn't a good idea, but can't undo the law, so, oh, I lost my queen. Then the king's personal attendants proposed, because of course you don't want a grumpy king, because if the king is grumpy, heads get cut off. The personal attendants proposed, let's do a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of the realm to bring all these beautiful young women into the harem at the citadel of Susa. Then let them be placed under the care of the king's eunuchs, who will pretty them up, and then the king can have a different virgin, whichever one you want to think of, every night, and then the king won't be so grumpy anymore. Great idea, he thinks. So they do it. And in the citadel of Susa, a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish. Now, all of y'all probably didn't pay attention to this, but wait a minute. Tribe of Benjamin, son of Kish. There's a very famous man in Israel's history of the tribe of Benjamin. Who's the son of Kish? Anybody know who that is?
Saul.
Yes, Saul. I didn't warn you. Saul. Mordecai and Saul. Right away, there's a line connected here. Who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. Among those taken captive with Jehoiachin, king of Judah. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadashah, who he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This young woman, who was also known as Esther, Esther Ishtar, there's a connection there, had a lovely figure and was beautiful. Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when the mother and father died. And when the king's orders and edicts had been proclaimed, many young women were brought to the citadel of Susa and put under the care of the steward. Esther was taken to the king's palace and entrusted to the eunuch who had charge of the harem. And she pleased him and won favor. Immediately, he provided her with her beauty treatments and special food. Remember the beginning of Daniel, similar story in some ways. He assigned to her 7 female attendants, selected from the king's palace, and moved her and her attendants into the best place in the harem. Esther had now revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. They are, in some ways, completely assimilating into the Persian Empire. The threat of God's people is being lost. Now, the king was attracted to Esther more than to any of the other women, and she won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he sent a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his nobles and officials, and he proclaimed a holiday throughout the provinces and distributed gifts with royal liberality. We saw that before, right? Now, there's actually, because I do these rough drafts, I always get feedback from some of my Jewish listeners, and I'd have to pursue this a little. This is a very controversial book, actually, amongst Jewish readers. There are some people that wonder, should this book be in the Bible? One of the reasons that there's long been a lot of controversy about this book is, how can you have a book in the Bible that doesn't name God? Because the name of God isn't found in this book. But sort of like the beginning of Exodus, when there you see that Israel has multiplied, it's sort of an implicit way of saying, is God behind the scenes? As who gave Esther her beauty? Who put Esther in Susa? Is God working even when nobody mentions his name and nobody knows he's there? When the virgins had assembled the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. But Esther had kept her family background and nationality, just as Mordecai had told her, had kept it secret, for she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions, as she had done when he was bringing her up. During the time Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, 2 of the king's officers who were guarding the doorway became angry and conspired to kill the king. Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. And when the report was investigated and found to be true, the 2 officials were impaled on poles. All of this was recorded in the book of the annals of the presence of the king. Now there begins to arise in the book a tension, because Mordecai and Esther, are they part of the empire or not? They seem to have assimilated, but there's always something different. Now, if you read the story, there's another character that comes up. His name is Haman. And Haman, well, we'll read about him now. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. Now, if you remember, Mordecai, tribe of Benjamin, son of Kish, making us think about Saul. Saul was instructed to wipe out a group of people, and he didn't do it. Samuel came up and judged him for that, and the kingdom was taken from Saul because of his refusal to obey God. Instead of wiping out the people, Saul enriched himself, by taking that people instead of imposing the ban as had been done on Jericho. Haman is a descendant of those people that Saul refused to wipe out. All of the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him homage. Oh. Then the king's official at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command?" So is Mordecai a good servant of the empire? Or a bad servant of the empire? Or not in the empire? How does Mordecai stand with respect to the rest of the world? And this isn't just a question about Mordecai. As we're going to see in a minute, this is a question about the Jews in this imperial world. Therefore, they told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated. Because again, remember, everyone's looking at Vashti. Will that be tolerated? Will Mordecai's behavior be tolerated by Haman? Because how does the empire work? Kiss up, kick down. That's how it works. For he had told them he was a Jew. And the Jews are different. The Jews don't practice everything that everyone in the empire does. You see that in the book of Daniel. The Jews stick to themselves. They don't do the public ceremonies. They don't do the public practices. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down and pay an honor, he was enraged. Oh, but there's a problem. Remember what Mordecai did for the king before? He's in the empire, but not of him. Having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Killing Mordecai isn't enough. Let's kill all of his kin and family. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. So in the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan, the poor, that means the lot, was cast in the presence of Haman to select a day and a month, and it fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. Then Haman said to Xerxes, here again we have, oh, Xerxes, I've got an idea for a law. You think Xerxes, who's already been bit by this practice of having these irrevocable laws, might have learned a little something about pulling the trigger on these laws? Apparently not. So basically, Haman gets into law an idea that, well, there's a certain people dispersed among the peoples of all the provinces of your kingdom who keep themselves separate. Their customs are different from those of all other people, and they do not obey the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. Xerxes didn't learn anything from the Vashti incident. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I will give 10,000 talents of silver. That is an enormous amount of silver. A talent is a lot. 10,000 talents of silver to the king's administrators for the royal treasury. So not only is it a bad idea, but it's coming with an enormous bribe. And then Haman has his plot to destroy Israel. Back to Saul in the Old Testament. Now, there's a lot that goes on now for a while. It's a great story, so I encourage you to read it. Tension between Haman and Esther and buttering him up, because Haman doesn't know that Esther is a Jew, because Mordecai told her to keep it quiet, and on and on. It's a great, great story. Definitely read it. Esther and Mordecai need to save Israel. That's what the book's about. God isn't present. Mordecai and Esther have taken Persian names. They've assimilated into the empire, but they can't really assimilate because they're God's people. And this should also be read not only in terms of Mordecai and Saul, but the long line of Israelite women who save Israel. The midwives in Egypt, not sure whether they're Israelite or not. Moses' wife, not Israelite. Ruth, not Israelite. Bathsheba basically makes sure that Solomon becomes king and not some of the other competitors. Rahab saves Israel coming into the promised land. There's a long line of women in the Old Testament that are messianic to a degree. They save their people, but they do so in sort of a womanly, feminine way. And that's also true of Esther. Now, Haman's got himself in trouble, but he's not in trouble yet. But he's going to destroy the Jews. And this gets reported to Esther. And she sends him to Mordecai and says, you better know this is coming. All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that if any man or woman approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law. They shall be put to death unless the king extends the golden scepter to them and spares their lives. Really tough to get on his agenda. Because Mordecai says, Esther, you got to act. You got to do something. When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back his answer. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. Esther, don't think this won't come around to you at some point. That's not how politics works. Somebody's going to be your enemy. Someone's going to figure it out, and they're going to get you too. Don't think you can ride out this storm in the palace. If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. Mordecai has faith. But you and your father's family will perish. And you know, and who knows, but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. God is hidden. He's behind the scenes. He's working providentially. He's doing his thing. Nobody's naming his name, but he's working. Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, nights, or a day, and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. Esther might be a savior, and she does so at the risk of her life. There's a messianic element to her in this story. So Mordecai went away and carried out all of Esther's instructions. Now, there's a whole bunch of drama. King Xerxes, like he had with Vashti, regrets once again making a bad law, can't undo it. So he's going to make another law that basically says the Jews can fight back. The king's edict granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate the armed men of any nationality or province who might attack them and their women and children, and to plunder the property of their enemies. Oh, now it's basically going to be open warfare, but the Jews can protect themselves. Okay. Level playing field? The day appointed for the Jews to do this in all the provinces was the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar. And a copy of the edict went all the way out. So it's at least going to be a fair fight. But Mordecai is in many ways the queen's father, adopted father. When Mordecai left the king's presence, he was wearing royal robes of blue and white. Remember blue and white from the first chapter? A large crown of gold and a purple robe of fine linen. Remember purple linen in the first chapter? The text is quite clearly connecting Mordecai with the upper echelon of Persian power. Has Mordecai now become of the empire? And the city of Susa held a joyous celebration. Another celebration. We had a celebration at the beginning. We had a celebration when Esther became queen. And now there's another celebration. Now Mordecai is the number two man. For the Jews, it was a time of happiness and joy, gladness and honor. Hometown boy makes good. He's one of us. He's second in command in the empire. For such a time as this, we really need him there now, because if all of our enemies are going to attack us, boy, do we have an advantage if our man is number two in the empire. Fair fight? Not anymore. The Jews have an advantage. In every province, in every city to which the edict of the king came, there was joy and gladness among the Jews with feasting and celebration. And many people of other nationalities became Jews because fear of the Jews had seized them. Everybody, before it was going to be the Jews are going to be wiped out. Now the Jews are going to do it to everyone. The Jews have, in a sense, their thumb on the scales of the empire. They have the power of the empire behind them. And Mordecai, son of Saul. Saul was the first king of Israel.
Yeah.
Saul lived a long life, and it was a great kingdom. And no. What happened with Saul and Israel? Israel descended into a tyranny, and everyone was afraid of Saul. And now, people are afraid of the Jews and the Persian Empire. On the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the edict commanded by the king was carried out, and on this day the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, but now the tables were turned and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them, and the Jews assembled in their cities and all the provinces of King Xerxes to attack those determined to destroy them, and no one could stand against them because the peoples of all the other nationalities were afraid of them. And all the nobles of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and the king's administrators helped the Jews because fear of Mordecai had seized them. How should we feel about this story? Mordecai was prominent in the palace, and his reputation spread throughout the provinces, and he became more and more powerful. Now, this is really hard for us to think about, because on one hand, this is the best thing. The people of God have empire behind them, and they're going to be protected and flourish. That's a wonderful thing. The people of God were the victims, and now they're in the upper hand, and they have the upper hand, and they won't be destroyed. In fact, they will now flourish because of the power of empire. Mordecai is in many ways a messianic figure too. Esther is sort of a female messianic figure. Mordecai is a male messianic figure. This is what it means to be a Messiah. Remember how David overturned, wouldn't lay a hand on Saul, overturned the power of the Philistines, delivered his people. Now Mordecai is delivering his people from the power of the enemies of Jews within the Persian Empire, with the power of empire behind him. But what did we read again in Habakkuk? What is the warning that we were given? What was the warning that was given to Israel before Saul? So this is something of celebration, but it's clouded and it's colored. See, the enemy is puffed up. His desires are not upright. The righteous person will live by their righteousness. Indeed, wine betrays him. What kind of power will Mordecai wield? Nearly all men can stand adversity. But if you want to test a man's character, give him power. The way of empire, kiss up, kick down, my well-being at your expense, practice here. And on one hand, it is something worth celebrating and has been celebrated in Jewish communities ever since. We celebrate the 4th of July when we defeated the British. Celebrate VE Day when victory in Europe and victory over Japan in the Second World War. When your side wins, it is absolutely right and good to celebrate. But what does Messiah mean? Is Mordecai the kind of Messiah we're looking for? Wasn't Mordecai's sense of Messiahship exactly what they were looking for when Jesus came on the scene? Jesus, we want you to be another Mordecai. Maybe you can get it to the upper echelon of Rome and bring our people to the top of the stack all over the world and have us kill and enrich ourselves by the enemy. But isn't that what Saul did? Can another empire built on bloodshed really heal the world? Are we going to kill our way out of this mess? Can empire be redeemed? And then we see Jesus. And what happens in the Gospels is the entire idea of what it means to be Messiah is transformed by him. Everyone wanted him to be Mordecai. No. A different kind of Messiah would be needed, not just to take over empire and use its tools to defeat evil. That decree to exterminate the Jews was evil. In a sense, can you really destroy evil with evil? Or don't you just continue the cycle? But one who would defeat those tools themselves would come. A better Mordecai and Esther would arise to share with the rest of the world what God's chosen people had suffered and would triumph through. Can you see the connection with Advent here? How this coming of a king will be so different from Mordecai and royal robes. In some ways, it's a little more like Esther, because she had to do it from below. Jesus comes and, in a sense, fulfills Mordecai and Esther. We await the coming of the Messiah. That's what Advent is. It's his preparation. In his first coming, he came to absorb wrath. He didn't bring judgment, he bore judgment. And he didn't do it to strike fear in his enemies. His enemies weren't afraid of him. Some of them mocked him. Remember the Roman centurion at the foot of the cross? What does he say when he sees Jesus crucified? This is the Son of God. What does this say about God? What does this reveal? Because can't God crush us? Yes. But he can't both crush us and have us. And he finally wants to have us. Mordecai can't make that turn. Jesus will. While we were yet sinners, ignorant of the mercy of God, he gave himself up. And it's for that reason that we eat this meal. This is my body, and this is my blood. On the night that our Lord was betrayed, betrayed by whom? Betrayed by someone he picked for his inner circle. On the night that our Lord was betrayed, he took bread and he broke it. And he didn't say, "This will be like the enemies. We will break them." No. He said, "This is my body. My body." Mordecai's body wasn't broken. Esther's body wasn't broken. But Jesus says, "This is my body broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me."